Hello and welcome to episode 424 of the Thinking LSAT podcast. I'm Ben Olson and with me is Nathan Fox. We're the co-founders of LSATdemon.com and the LSAT Demon Daily podcast. Be LSAT famous. Share news and ask questions on our website, thinkinglsat.com. Thursday, November 23rd, 2023 at 5 p.m. Pacific, 8 p.m. Eastern. Nathan, you're going to be doing a free class. Do you know what you're going to be covering?
Same thing I cover every damn time, which is the LSAT is easy. I'm clearer and clearer the longer I teach LSAT about what my primary mission is as an LSAT instructor. And it really is to show you how easy the LSAT is, not how easy it can be or like in some fantasy land, but my job is to convince you that the questions are solvable one at a time. And it's not going to be gimmicks, not going to be these weird tactics like, oh, do this one weird trick. It's not like that. It's like we're going to read a bunch of LSAT questions very carefully and we're going to show how they essentially answer themselves. Like all you really have to do is understand what the hell it's saying. Just read what it says, react to it, understand what they're saying. You know, not just the topic, not just the what, but what about it? What do they want? Why are these words arranged in this order on the page? And when you figure out the meaning of what the hell they're asking you, they're not asking you unsolvable questions. I mean, I think, what do you think, Ben? It's like 98% of all LSAT questions. There's just no debate. It's not close. There's one answer that credibly answers the question. And there's four that don't.
I agree. And the vast, vast majority of our explaining involves helping someone understand how they misunderstood something that they either read too quickly or didn't take the time to just process.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, I do think that it's the biggest difference between how I teach LSAT or how Ben teaches LSAT and what you're likely to see out there in LSAT world, because I just know that there are so many of these classes that are trying to get you to some cheesy, you know, oh, we're going to get you to our 7-point improvement if you do our full class, and, you know, it will guarantee 7 points. And if not, you can retake our already shitty class again to try to get your 7-point improvement. You know, that's what's out there. Yeah. And what we do is show you how easy the LSAT actually is. And when we do that, that's how we get 17 and 27 point or sometimes 30 something point improvements. I mean, how many, Ben, over the past few months, how many emails do we get of people saying, you changed my life, I improved by 30 points or 25 points or whatever? Like, there's only one way you do that.
Yeah.
And that's by realizing that the LSAT is easy. So that's the purpose of that class on Thursday, November 23rd. It's also the purpose of every class I teach. I teach 2 or 3 times a week. And if you want to see how easy the test is, I hope you will come join us.
Yeah. You can sign up for that at lsat.link/free. If you miss the class, you can also go there and watch the recording after Nathan does it.
Excellent. Hope to see everybody there.
Yeah. Okay. Eric submitted this article. The article is Law School Financial Data is About to Get More Transparent. This is on Reuters. It was published, pretty recently, right? Yeah, October 4th. So last week. I think we just need to read through it. Thank you, Eric, for finding this. Nathan, do you want to read it?
Yeah, this is from Karen Sloan on Reuters. I've seen Karen's name a lot around pre-law journalism. It's almost like she's the only reporter on this beat. Mm-hmm. Love to get her on the podcast sometime to talk about these issues. But it says aspiring lawyers will soon have more comprehensive financial data to consider when choosing a law school. The U.S. Department of Education said on September 27th that it has adopted a new set of rules for graduate programs, including law schools, that are meant to improve transparency around earning outcomes, costs, and borrowing for potential students. So this is targeting grad programs specifically. It's not going to address, you know, a bigger issue, which is undergrad debt.
Yeah.
But I think that graduate debt in a lot of cases is particularly egregious because there's so many of these, you know, master's programs that just don't qualify you to do jack shit. And the JD is very similar for those people who are not going to practice law. Like, if you're not going to be a barred attorney, law school is just way not a good investment. And so anyway, law schools.
I would add, I think there's two problems here too. And that is that for grad programs, I believe one, the federal PLUS loan is not capped in a way that I think it is for undergrad. And two, students can take out the PLUS loans. Whereas for undergrad, you have to convince a parent to do that PLUS loan. So there's some friction there, and maybe a wiser, older person saying, hold on, they still end up doing them. And I don't know that they should, but for grad programs, like the student, I think, can just go out and get those loans. And that's unleashing a lot of cash.
Yeah. If you're a 17 or 18 year old looking to get extra funding, you know, more than the federal loans for undergrad, you have to get your parents to sign off. Now you're a wise 22-year-old,
yeah,
or, you know, 32-year-old who's like getting sucked into some master's program or a JD program, and here the U.S. Department of Education is going to say, okay, so you don't have mom and dad who have to co-sign, but we are going to do some things. Law schools will have to report figures including their total cost of attendance, average amount borrowed to pay for school, and typical graduate earnings. All of that information will be compiled on a new Education Department website, and programs with high debt levels and low graduate earnings over a 2-year period will be subject to a new disclosure requirement to ensure that prospective students understand the risk. They're going to begin collecting the data in July of 2024, and then they're going to make it available to the public online. Who knows when that'll happen? Probably nothing actually comes out of this until 2025. Would you agree?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The trickle down of that. Or anyway, some of these things, right, they don't actually, these regs come into place, and then the regulated maneuver things in such a way that the information doesn't have the impact that maybe people were hoping it would.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not thrilled about this, but it is nice, I guess. You know, it's encouraging to see that the U.S. Department of Education is moving in this direction. We've been talking about that on this podcast for years, that we think that the spiraling law school tuitions and spiraling law school debt issue should be solved by the U.S. Department of Education stepping in and saying, hey, what are we doing?
Yeah.
Letting people sign their lives away. Like, what are we guaranteeing here? And that seems like they're going in that direction with, like, hey, you know, are these degrees actually resulting in higher earning? Let's be honest. Like, there's no point to it unless it's like, you know, we measure whether it gave us value in economic terms, or at least that's one very convenient way to measure. And so that's what is going to be happening, allegedly.
Yeah. So further into this article, there is more information about some of these schools, for example, debt to income ratios and some statistics on the amount of debt that lawyers end up racking up.
It says, a May analysis of Education Department data by Notre Dame law professor Derek Muller found that Western Michigan University Cooley Law School, Atlanta's John Marshall Law School, and Appalachian School of Law were among the schools with the highest debt-to-income ratios. Lowest debt-to-income ratio? Harvard.
Wow.
High student debt loads have been a major concern in the legal profession for years, says this article. A 2020 survey of young lawyers by the American Bar Association found that more than 75% of respondents had at least $100,000 in student loans at graduation. 75%, Ben, owe at least $100,000 after law school.
Oh,
yeah.
That's a burden.
Over half had more than $150,000 in student loans, and one in four owed $200,000 or more.
That's a wild sum.
Yeah, it is life-changing debt. And many of these respondents said that the debt had impacted life decisions, such as postponing marriage, buying a house, having children, those wow. types of things.
Yeah.
So anyway. Okay. Next up on our agenda, we have an email here from Jacob.
Subject: questions I've asked every lawyer I could find, but no one has been able to answer them. Howdy. Bullet points rock. Says anonymous. Who is it?
Who's then Jacob. Giving us a bunch of bullet points.
Yep. Yeah. Bullet point number one. Do I apply to schools in the state I want to live or go to the best or only options I get?
What? I mean, only options you get. There's no limit. You have unlimited options. I don't understand that question, really. There's 200 law schools you can apply to. You should go to LSATdemon.com/scholarships and you should plug in your LSAT and your GPA, and you should go hunting for schools that are likely to make you a good offer. Whether that's schools in your state or schools out of your state, depends on what state you live in. If you live in California or New York or somewhere like that, you might have plenty of in-state options. If you live in Mississippi, you don't. So, yeah, go pick a range of schools, probably 15 schools minimum, and plan on applying to, a portfolio of schools so that you get back a portfolio of options.
Do you want to go where you want to live?
Well, I mean, yes and no. If I lived in Mississippi, depends on whether I want to stay in Mississippi.
No. Do you want to go? Should this person go where they want to live, or should
go to school where you want to live?
Yeah.
Generally, yes. I mean, if you have a place that you know you want to live, especially if there's a place where you want to live for sure, then you should probably go to school in that state. I mean, if I wanted to live in Minnesota, then yeah, I'm going to be looking for law schools in Minnesota, because any regional school in Minnesota is going to give you probably lots of options in Minnesota. You don't need to go to Harvard in order to go get a job in Minnesota. If I wanted to live in New York City and practice big law, I might not, like, I don't have to go to school in New York in order to facilitate that. You know, like if I went to UCLA or if I went to Berkeley or if I went to whatever. Like, there's great law schools that will probably get you those big law New York City connections if that's what you want to do. That said, if that's what you want to do, you should probably also be applying to lots of schools in New York and see if any of the New York schools give you a great offer.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. We on the same page there?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
And you said generally local, right? And that's true, because for the vast majority of people, they're not going to the top 14, which have a national reach. If you don't go to a school that has a national reach, then you kind of need to go to a school that's close to where you want to live, because that's their reach.
That's worth stretching. I mean, worth stressing that the vast majority of lawyers do not go to top 14 schools.
By definition, right? You can't fit them all in there.
Now, most lawyers that make $200,000 plus starting, they're going to be wildly overrepresented in lawyers from those schools, because you can go to Stanford Law School, finish absolutely dead last in your class, and still waltz right into the white shoe big time law firm. And you just can't do that at UC Hastings, you know, or any regional school, like schools ranked 50 or whatever. If you finish last in those programs, you are not going into big law.
Yeah.
I mean, or it's going to be real that, you know, you might have some connections where you're going to get in there, but like on average, they're not even going to interview you during on-campus interviewing if you don't kick ass at a school like that. But if you want to work in some small mid-sized firm, if you want to work in public defense, if you want to work in the prosecutor's office, there's lots of other jobs that you can do from regional schools that just aren't that six-figure plus starting salary world. The more you're interested in that, if you're doing this for the money, the more you need to be thinking about going to the highest ranked school you can get into.
Yeah. Next question. When does going for free outweigh rank, and when does going for rank outweigh going for free?
It depends.
It depends, just, but I will say that the default presumption should be to go for free.
Yep.
And the reason for that is that when you get into a school that's, say, ranked 20, I'm just throwing out numbers here, that means you can almost certainly get into a school ranked like in the 30s for free. So you're saving yourself $150,000, $200,000, but only dropping in the rankings by 10, which means nothing. So the value lost is significantly smaller than the money saved in most cases. So just plan on going for free and then maybe break that rule if there's some compelling reason to do so.
Totally. I mean, every applicant should plan on getting at least one full ride offer. Mm-hmm. How do you do that? You go to LSAT.com, LSATdemon.com/scholarships, and you put in your LSAT and your GPA, and you apply to at least a handful of schools that our estimator thinks will probably offer you a full ride. Not all of those schools will offer you a full ride, but the idea is that if you apply to five schools that are lit up in green on our estimator, one of those schools ought to give you a really generous offer. Then you can compare that to whatever other offers you got. Mm-hmm. And, you know, many of our LSAT Demon teachers, like our teachers do leave us and go off to Harvard and Yale and places like that. They make very considered decisions before they do that, before they decide to incur that debt. They're doing it for very specific reasons, and they are turning down full ride offers when they do that. I would encourage Jacob to cross this bridge when he comes to it. I don't think it's worth, like, assuming that Jacob has not yet even applied for law school or taken the LSAT. I think you're talking about issues that you really shouldn't be addressing for like a year.
Yep.
Once you do get all of your offers, if you're a Demon student or, you know, former member of the Demon community, we'd love to talk to you about what your offers actually are and help you make those decisions. But right now, all we're doing is just speculating.
Yep.
I totally agree, though. Default, don't pay for law school. And then if you have some offers that look like, well, you know, but maybe this is worth it, well, okay, consider it at that point.
Yeah, exactly. Next, do I push for the 2024 school year or should I push for the 2025 and try to get the best possible score I can?
Obviously the latter. I mean, yeah. Get the best LSAT you can regardless of cycle. I can't, again, it's like impossible to stress it too much. All y'all rush into law school. You guys, year after year, cycle after cycle, is just lemmings plunging off the cliff to go pay too much to go to law school because you didn't get the best LSAT you could have gotten. And the people who stick with it and the people who, you know, like really decide to do it our way, that's maybe another reason why we get these 25, 30 point improvements out of people sometimes, is that they've decided, oh shit, I need to flip this whole thing on its head. Rather than deciding when I'm going to apply and then starting to prep for the LSAT and then rushing into it and taking LSATs late in the cycle and applying mid-cycle, instead of doing it that way because I'm in such a damn hurry to push for the 2024 school year, flip it. Ignore the application calendar. Don't think about when you're going to apply. Don't think about when you're going to start law school. Instead, just focus your energy on the LSAT and get the best possible score you can. It's going to open doors to schools and scholarships that are just not possible if you rush into it.
I was trying to think about an analogy while you were talking, and I think of travel, vacation travel.
Okay.
When you try to, you're like, oh yeah, you're like excited and you want to do something in the next month, and you're like trying to get flights and you're trying to get Airbnbs and everything's booked up and the flights are fucking expensive.
Yeah.
That's one way. Or you can say, next summer, this is what I'm going to do. And you start looking for options. Everything's available. Everything's cheaper.
You get more time to savor it, too. You know, like if you have it way out there on the calendar, then you get to enjoy that vacation way in advance. Yeah, I would encourage Jacob to think about enjoying law school way in advance. Like once you're in it, it's going to go by in a flash. And
you
can kind of like enjoy the anticipation of it, I think, maybe if you, or at least that's one way to think about it, is to push it out to 2025 and to say, yeah, you know, this is going to be, not only am I going to be in law school and be a baller or whatever I want to be, I'm going to be at a great school for a great price because I'm going to do this the right way.
Versus a, you know, harried vacation. It's like, cool. Oh, we got to go and do something fun, but it's like expensive, not the best views, all that stuff just because you rushed it.
And the incentives for, you know, everybody else who's giving you advice, the incentives are just lined up for them in a different way. I mean, the incentives are also lined up for Ben and I to tell you, oh, you should push right now, like join LSAT Demon Live today and start prepping. It's not too late for the 2024 school year. Which, you know, it's not too late for the 2024 school year necessarily if you're already prepping for the LSAT, I guess. But it's not optimal for the 2024 school year. And there's just no point. Like, why would anybody ever push? There's no, like, it'll be there in 2025 and 2026 and 2027.
Yeah.
I've been doing this for 15 years and it never, ever changes. It's always just the same deal next year, except for it's not the same deal next year. It's a wildly better deal next year because you're a way more qualified applicant next year if you work on your damn LSAT.
Eric notes, several other listeners have also asked for your thoughts on applying after the November or January LSAT this year.
Well,
same thing.
Again, and it's like every law school is going to tell you, absolutely apply this cycle. Every pre-law consultant who wants your business, who wants to start charging you thousands of dollars to work on your personal statement, every one of those people is going to say it's not too late. Right now is the perfect time to apply. And I don't think they're right. I think that they have incentives that might make them believe that that's right. But I do not think that that is the best advice for you, the applicant. The best advice for you, the applicant, is to ignore the application cycle entirely and focus on your LSAT.
I think this does come back to an underlying belief that your LSAT score can change. We see it all the time, so we know there's that potential. I think some of these other folks, they maybe just don't have as much faith in that. And if you don't believe it can change, then yeah, these other beliefs make sense. But
we need to make a presentation, you know, like we need to show up at these pre-law conferences with a video that has 10 fucking people in a row saying, I studied for the LSAT for a year and improved my score by 25 points. Like, I want to see 10 different people in a row saying that exact same thing. I improved by 20 points. I improved by 30 points. I improved by 35 fucking points.
Yeah. Astronomically different.
Because I think that there's this myth out there, like the schools are more than happy to tell you, oh yeah, most people don't improve. Nah, when they retake, most people only improve by 2 points when they retake. So you should apply right now today.
Yeah. Yeah. Better get ahead of the curve than.
We're accepting applications now.
Yeah.
The seats are limited. Mm-hmm. Seats are not fucking limited. Next year, you will have a giant empty classroom that you have to fill again. And the year after that. And the year after that.
Yep.
Seats are unlimited. And it's just a matter of how much you're going to pay. Yeah. Anyway, again, all of your advisors are going to tell you the exact opposite of this. They're all going to try to push you down this road. And I'm here to tell you that you can perfect your logic games. You can get to the point where you're never going to miss a question on the games ever. You can get wildly better at reading comp and logical reasoning. You can improve your LSAT by like 20 points. You can end up being, you know, you can just flip the whole thing on its head. Like there are schools right now with your 158 that are definitely going to deny you. And if you improved that by 20 points to a 178, those schools would be rolling out the red carpet. Full ride. So that's why we do what we do.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah. Last bullet point. Jacob, right? Jacob says, I don't want to just stop at law. I want to know how to, quote, collect businesses, understand tax law, asset protection, and how common law can help. What should I look for in a school to help me get there? I don't understand the question.
Well, sorry for laughing at you, Jacob. I'm laughing at all of everybody, like just including myself when I was in your shoes. Everybody is just so naive about what law school is. That last bullet makes me really want Jacob not to pay for law school. Like, do not pay a dime for law school, Jacob, no matter what. Like, it's not worth it for you because you don't want to just practice law. You're not it's way riskier for someone like Jacob. This idea that like, oh, I'm going to law school so that I can like, I'm going to level up my entrepreneurialness or whatever.
Yeah.
It just is so it's far-fetched. Like once you've gone through law school, you would understand. But law school is clearly professional training for lawyers. Its only purpose is to qualify you to sit the bar and to be a practicing attorney. And if that's not what you want to do, if your dream is not to practice law, then there's just no need to go to law school. I mean, you're not going to understand tax law after law school. I took multiple tax law classes in law school, which by the way are electives and not even required for anybody. And you wouldn't just magically understand tax law from that. Like the only people who actually understood those classes were the people who were already accountants to begin with.
Well, even so, you're focusing on some esoteric component of the tax law that may or may not apply to you ever.
Yeah, asset protection. Oh, and then this last bit, how common law can help.
Huh?
What? I don't even, yeah, I mean, I don't even understand that question as a law school graduate. I don't understand that question. Neither does Ben. So, I mean, and that's, it's fine, Jacob. Like I'm not trying to beat Jacob up. I just, it makes me so nervous about all these people incurring any debt for this product. Like this product is not a good investment. Like full stop. It's just not.
No,
like,
I agree. And I'm just thinking about the admissions officer in a school who's hearing people say this, because people must come to them and say this as well. And they must have some sort of narrative in their head, like, oh, they'll do anything
with a law degree, Ben.
Yeah.
It's not just only to practice law. Many of our graduates go on to this job and that job and the other job. And it's like, oh yeah, they decided that they hated practicing law, so they did something else. But the fact that someone did that doesn't mean that it's a good idea to incur this debt. And like, you know, it's also true that some people go to medical school and then decide not to be doctors.
Yeah.
But that's not a good reason to go to medical school.
Yeah.
It's a bad reason to go to medical
school. I'll better understand the health system.
The human body, and I'll become a better, like, if you want to understand the law, Jacob, Wikipedia.com.
Yeah.
Like for real. Like you want to know how the actual system works, go to Wikipedia and, you know, read for the rest of your life and you will understand more and more and more about how the system works. But law school is you're there to tick a box. You're there to get your JD so that you can sit for the bar. And it's an academic, while you're there, it's an academic competition to see who's going to rank high enough to work in big law. You know, who's a good enough worker bee to come make $200,000 and work 70 hours a week. That's what law school is while you're there. Yeah. And boy, I went into law school exactly the same way. It's like, well, you know, I don't really, I might want to practice law, but I think I more just want to like start businesses and I'm going to learn about business. Mm. No, you don't learn about business. It's not what it's for.
Yeah.
Next.
Next is from Aiden. Yeah. The subject is almost there, but struggling to go perfect on games.
I've been studying with the demon since this past May, and games have consistently been my lowest section. I started out around minus 13 in games, and I've improved a lot since then. What I'm frustrated by is that RC and LR are typically minus 2 to minus 0 each, but games continue to drag me down by minus 3 to minus 6 lately. What can I do over this last hump in my game's performance? For some context, I typically miss two somewhere in the first three games. Ew. And then the rest of the ones I miss are due to running out of time on game four. I made my highest practice test score of 177 back in July with games minus three on that test. I've only ever scored perfectly on a game's timed section once. Wow. My last full-length PT was a 170, minus 2 LR, minus 2 RC, minus 4 games. I'm hyper aware that my scores would be consistently in the mid-170s if I could just get perfect games, exclamation point. I guess first, congratulations, Aiden, on the improvement that you've made so far, going from 13, minus 13 in the games. So that was 10 out of 23.
Yep.
And now you're getting 17 to 20 out of 23.
Mm-hmm.
That's a pretty big part of the bridge that you have painted. You know, like that's a pretty strong performance so far. I think you should take a lot of encouragement from that. I understand that you're frustrating, but you should, you know, maybe look back at that progress and realize, oh yeah, okay, I'm getting it. I'm learning. But there's some stuff here that's a little worrisome, huh, Ben?
Yeah, well, I'm looking at the minus two in the first three games.
Yeah, what are you doing? Typically missing two somewhere in the first three games, because that means that you're randomly, like, for every one that you miss, there's probably another one where you got a little lucky and got it right.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and that applies, by the way, to all sections of the test, right? It's not just the ones you missed. It's those other ones that you kind of didn't really understand, and you sorted it out and you got it right, which, okay, that's good. But like, it's just, there are cracks in your foundation. So each one of those, it's like, yeah, dropping that point or dropping those points is a bummer, but it indicates something about the process, I think.
Yeah. There's something not quite right there, right? Not setting up the worlds well enough or something.
Well, you're just not answering the questions with certainty. Like, yeah. you haven't yet learned. I think people are so focused on, I have to finish the section on time, that then they'd make dumb mistakes on the way there. It could be that Aiden isn't investing enough in his setups, so he's not clear enough when he's solving the questions. It could also be that he is just being too casual on the questions, you know, not really reading them all the way through, see an answer that you like and pick it without ruling out the other answers. I don't know, man. It's like, you need to slow down, Aiden, and focus on accuracy. You've got to let games unlock themselves. And you got to just, like, you've got to go back to this slow is smooth, smooth is fast. I'm really not racing. I'm really not trying to finish the section. Instead, I'm just trying to get one perfect game, then two perfect games, then three perfect games, then, if time allows, four perfect games. Because right now, you know, if you're minus three to minus six, that's not really better than just getting three perfect games and then randomly guessing on the last game. I mean, it's barely better. I think, Aiden, like, take that to heart, right? Three perfect games is almost as good as you're doing right now. Realistically. Like, if you gave me the test,
yeah,
and my copy of the test only had the first three games in it, I'm going to basically perform the same as Aiden. Because I'm going to nail all three of those games, and then I'm going to bubble in random guesses for the fourth game.
Yeah.
And I might get one or two of those right. And it's like, how's that possible that I'm going to score the same as Aiden, even though I have a missing page of my test?
Yeah.
Well, Aiden, you're rushing through those three games where I'm going to harvest out all those points, and you're just not harvesting all the points because you're trying to do game four while you're still working on game one or game two.
Yeah.
We had an ask button question about premise indicators. Wow. Okay. So we're getting into the technical logical reasoning weeds here.
The question says, if a sentence starts with the word for, does that usually mean the prior sentence was the conclusion or at least the intermediary conclusion?
Well, it means it's a conclusion. So, and it can happen at the beginning of a sentence or it can happen in the middle of a sentence, but yeah, for means because or since, and it's always going to immediately precede a premise. And if the previous, I would say at the beginning of a sentence, is it always going to follow the conclusion or a conclusion? Maybe not.
No, it really depends on how the sentence that you're looking at is structured. So, for example, if I said to you, because it's hot outside,
I'm going to put on my bathing suit.
Yeah, I should wear a suit or something like that, right? Okay, well, the because preceded the premise, and then after that comma came the conclusion or a conclusion. And that can happen with for, but it can. I've also seen it used because for is a little different than you can't start a sentence with because and just have one clause. But for whatever reason, with for, it appears that you can on occasion. And so sometimes the for will. That's what's happening in this example here that Eric shared.
Oh, yeah. So that's one sentence and it's just a premise.
Yeah.
And it starts with for, and it does follow a conclusion of the argument.
Yeah.
If you do it in the middle of a sentence, it definitely always follows the conclusion of or a conclusion of the argument. You know, blah, 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 for yada, yada, yada. The yada, yada, yada has to be a premise in support of the blah, blah, blah.
Exactly.
But I mean, at the beginning of a sentence, that's really strange. But yeah, I guess it's always going to be a premise.
Yeah.
But you could say a premise, comma, then the conclusion.
Absolutely.
If you start the sentence with for.
Yep.
For it is raining outside. I shall wear my galoshes.
It's strange, but the LSAT does use for quite a bit as a premise indicator.
It does. I think I see it more often in the middle of a sentence, in which case it would always be a conclusion for a premise. But at the beginning of a sentence, you could certainly start for a premise, comma, a conclusion.
Yeah.
Okay. Next.
Yep. This is another ask button question. For strengthen and weaken questions, should the answer choice I select be something I'm adding to the premises or evidence to make the argument stronger? Or should I be using the answer choice to strengthen / weaken the conclusion? It's a weird either or because you're actually doing both.
Well,
you're adding a premise to the argument that will then have the effect of strengthening or weakening the conclusion.
Yeah, and I think you should really separate out strengthen and weaken here.
Sure.
You know, I think it's two different types of questions. For strengthen, I think of it this way, you know, who's your favorite NFL team? Ben, you have an NFL team?
No, I don't. Definitely not. Well, if I had one, it'd be the 49ers, but
yeah. Okay, perfect. I love rooting against the 49ers because everyone from the Bay Area is like obnoxious about the 49ers. They're really good this year, by the way. So if you ever wanted to watch the Niners, you should watch the Niners this year.
Okay.
If the Niners wanted to get better, if they wanted to strengthen their team.
Yep.
There's a couple different ways that they could strengthen their team. Let's ignore special teams because who cares about punters? Let's be honest. They could add offense or defense.
Mm-hmm.
To strengthen their team. They could add offense or they could add defense.
Sure.
And adding offense is like adding a premise that helps you prove your conclusion. So you've got a premise over here. You've got a conclusion over there. You're trying to get from here to there. Trying to get from behind the line of scrimmage to the end zone.
Yep.
You know, you get like good players that help you carry the ball to the destination. That's strengthening by adding a premise that like supports the argument.
Mm-hmm.
But you can also strengthen by adding defense. You add a super badass linebacker or whatever. Well, you're not positively moving the ball toward the end zone, but you're defending against the opposition moving the ball toward the end zone. So you're strengthening by adding defense. And sometimes on strengthen questions, you can get surprised by answers that defend the argument against a particular attack. I don't think it's reasonable to think that that is like, it's not building the argument. It's not offensive. It's just defensive. It's just like, oh, also this other thing over here is not true.
Mm-hmm.
And that other thing being something that would be really bad for your case. This is why we attack every logical reasoning passage It's why we don't care in advance whether it's a strengthen or weaken or any other type of question. I just don't give a shit because I have to know what the strengths and weaknesses are of the argument. I always read the argument without knowing the question type so that I can just be critical of it. All I really want to do is attack. And I frequently, on strengthen questions, I'll either spot, hey, there's a missing piece of your argument. There's an obvious place like, dude, we need a tight end for our offense. Let's put that in there. Other times it's like, ooh, this sounds like it could be the case, but man, there's a potential problem here. Mm-hmm. And if you're on the attack and you can see how the argument could be attacked, it's like you're spotting a hole in the defense. And then on a strengthen question, you plug that hole in the argument or you defend that argument against some weird outside attack. And it might have nothing to do with like connecting the premises to the conclusion. It could just be like, oh, there's a potential objection out here that a common sense smart person is going to attack us with. Yeah. Let's make sure we put it in the record that that's not true. And that's a strengthener by defending it against an attack. Weaken is a little different. Weaken is just anything that puts the argument in a bad spot. I don't think it's reasonable to say something like it's adding a premise to the argument because it's not really like that. It's just like, hey, if we could get this into the record, right? You're clearly on the defense you're on the defense team when you're doing a weaken question. It's like, hey, here's their argument. Let me throw a monkey wrench in there.
New information.
So, yeah. And anything that, if true, puts them in a bad spot. And now it could be like the exact opposite of a premise that they clearly need. You know, if they're like, anytime it rains, I should put on my galoshes. Therefore, I shall put on my galoshes. Well, you're assuming it's raining. And the other side, if they could prove it's not raining, well, now your argument makes no sense.
Yeah.
That's not really adding a premise to the argument. Rather, it's like, okay, if this fact were known, then this argument is now in a bad spot. So it's like, what would the other side like to introduce into this argument? That's really what you're doing on a weakened question.
Yeah.
Do we think that answers the ask?
I think so. Yeah.
Wait.
The next one is from Jewel. The subject is stamina a factor for making the jump into the high 170s?
No, but I'll read the email. I just don't think stamina, like, get better at the actual content of the test. I don't think stamina has anything to do with it. At least it doesn't have anything to do with it if you're anything like me. The only thing that was holding me back from the high 170s was being good enough at the games. I was good enough at the LR. I was good enough at the RC. I sucked at the games. You know, like it, almost exactly, by the way, like Aiden. When I started, I think I was like minus 13 on the games. And I prepped enough to where I got perfect at the games. And I did not do that by stamina. I did it by doing like a little bit of games every day until it like clicked. And once it clicked, I started scoring perfect sections and it had nothing to do with stamina. But I don't know. It could be different for different students. This student Jewel says, first, thank you guys so much. The demon has gotten me from a 148 diagnostic to a 169 on record.
Holy shit.
21 points already. And tons of practice tests in the 170s. The demon way works! ! I've gotten to a point in my studying where I can get perfect scores on each section when I take them individually, and sometimes on full tests as well. I've noticed when I take the full four section tests, I tend to do worse on the last two sections, no matter what they are. I'm laughing because other people say I do worse on the first two sections, no matter what they are. And I really think that this is an artifact of just small samples and possibly self-fulfilling prophecies. Like once you start to get this, I always do worse on the last two sections. Well, how much do you believe that? Because if you believe it a lot, it's going to become true. Do I just need to focus on building my stamina? What other things should I try? I would love to get something in the high 170s on an actual test, but what should I focus on to make this a more consistent jump? I have only gotten the high 170 scores for merged tests so far, and the others range from 170 to 174. All right, what do you think for Jewel?
It's certainly possible that something about her mindset when she goes into an individual section is such that, hey, this is what I got to do. I can do it. And she brings everything forward. But then when she's taking a test, she sort of starts to think about the test as a whole, maybe, or something like that. And so mentally, she's not going into each section just with 100% focus on that section. I think it could be something as small as when you do a test, just treat each section as an individual section, like when you do individual sections. Just be like, yeah, okay, I'm doing this. I'm not going to think about the other three until I get to the second section. And at that point, I'm not going to think about the remaining two or the previous one. Today I'm doing section two and I'm going to kill it. And then you do that for section three, do that for section four, and then you're done.
Yep. Because there's not really magic to it. It's easier than you think. The problem with Jewel is that, you know, Jewel, you're not a badass at the test. Like, you're pretty good. You've made a damn good improvement. That's impressive. 169, good place to be. Is 169 an LSAT teacher? No. Like, you're not qualified to teach for us until you score, you know, an official test in the 170s. Like, there's things about the test that you don't understand. Notice that she did use the word consistent. She thinks that consistency is the goal.
Mm-hmm.
But the reason why you're not consistent, Jewel, is that you're just not that good at the individual sections themselves. Now, I understand that you have scored in the high 170s on a blended test. I understand that sometimes you score close to perfect on LR and RC and games. Like, you can do each of the sections sometimes. But when you do score perfectly, it's because you're getting a little bit lucky. When you score poorly, it's because you're getting a little bit unlucky. Somewhere in the middle, you know, right now, Jewel is probably getting like 22 questions correct, plus or minus three on every section she does. So sure, when you merge those together, every once in a while, you got your best performance on all three and you end up with a high score. Other times, you know, you're not going to end up with your best performance. I guess I just want to, like, where Jewel needs to be reviewing individual questions, and hopefully she's doing that, right? She's bought into the demon way. She understands that the demon way works. I just want her to let go of this idea that consistency is really the goal. And instead, the goal is just get the question right. The one in front of you, get that question right. And when you go back and review, you know, I just don't care. It's like, well, but I only get a 169 when I do a full test. How do I become more consistent? Nah, what questions did you miss? Where did you drop your points on this exact test? Like, let's look at those mistakes. Let's also look maybe at the ones that you got right, but you weren't quite, you know, don't feel good about. Did you score perfect on the games? If you didn't score perfect on the games, let's look at what you did on game one. Like, were you efficient enough on game one? Were you efficient enough on game two? Were you efficient enough on game three? Did you miss any questions of the ones you attempted? Never should you do that on games. Like, you got to think about the quality of your understanding more than these, like, the statistics of how our performance, you know, these aggregate statistics that is the 120 to 180 LSAT score.
Yeah.
The only thing that you can focus on, the only thing you can do anything about is let's look at your mistakes. I don't know if that's helpful. Okay, we have an email here from Anonymous. Anonymous is apparently fast approaching 170 plus. However,
Anonymous writes, I graduated from undergrad 10 years ago with a straight up horrible GPA of 2.6. This was due to a severe substance abuse problem that I struggled with for the majority of my life. In the decades since then, however, I have successfully completed intensive treatment and feel the most capable I have ever been. I've spent much time trying to figure out the best way to express this in my apps, but it has been a struggle. Any advice or encouragement would be appreciated. Thanks. Disclose whatever you have to disclose, but hopefully that's nothing. And if that is nothing, then focus on what you're killing or succeeding at these days. I don't see a need to address this unless there's something that's required.
I tend to agree. It was 10 years ago. Everybody has shit 10 years ago. I mean, almost everybody who's applying to law school later in life did poorly in undergrad.
Yeah, that's why they didn't go immediately to law school.
In many cases, yeah. I mean, there, I guess there are occasionally people who 10 years ago had a 4.0, but most people who have a 4.0 apply, they're like right out of undergrad applying to law school. Yeah. So you're not unusual. You're a little older. You're applying with bad grades. I was a little older. I was applying with bad grades. I did not disclose anything. I didn't write an addendum about my GPA. My GPA was lower than yours. Mine rounds down to 2.5. I don't know if I had a substance abuse problem at the time. I drank a lot in college. So did everybody. I just didn't pay attention to college. I gave no shits about college. I had no intention of ever going to law school. I thought that undergrad was the end of the road. You know, first generation college student, C's get degrees. I graduated in 4 years. I thought I was totally successful, you know, getting a 2.5 and getting a degree and going to work. That was the end goal for me.
Yeah.
You know, I was taught that I would go to college. Nobody in my family had ever been to grad school. I didn't even know anybody who had been to grad school. And so I don't know, like, I don't think you need to. Yeah. I don't see how it helps you really to bring up I would probably omit severe substance abuse problem from my record entirely if I didn't have a DUI or something that I needed to disclose.
Even then, I would just disclose that and stop.
Well, yeah, especially then, if you had to disclose it, then you could disclose it. I don't think, like, is that really what you want your whole brand to be in your application? Because if you start writing about this, then it's like, okay, what we have here is a reclamation project. If you tell them about your severe substance abuse problem, they're gonna like imagine the worst.
You're also applying to school for a profession that is notoriously bad at substance abuse.
Right, like leads to all kinds of problems of alcoholism and depression and all, you know, like, yeah, it's so fraught. Why would you put this in your application? You could, like, don't even write a GPA addendum. Just get a kick-ass LSAT and then write your personal statement about the decade since then and how much ass you have kicked. Surely, well, you've been working.
I want to be clear, though. You said the decade since. That almost sounds like, oh, hey, I've been doing so well. No. We're still not responding to that previous problem. We're not even talking about it at all. We're just saying, hey, I had this job 2 years ago or last year, and this is how I helped the company succeed in one way.
Right.
Great.
Otherwise, you're like starting out by flashing a giant spotlight. You're commandeering the spotlight of the application and shining it on your 2.6.
Yeah. I'm trying to sell my house, but I want to point out all the problems that you might encounter once you become the new homeowner. No.
Yeah, it's you've moved past it, Anonymous, which is excellent. Congratulations.
Yeah.
What are you now doing? What have you been doing? Like, what do you got to show for it? Let's talk about the wins in your last 5, 2, 1 years of your life. Like, what have you been working on? What have you been kicking ass at? Show yourself as someone who is currently kicking ass and who has a 170 something official LSAT. You're always going to be a splitter. You know, no matter what you say, you're still going to be a 2.6 on the data that they have to report to the American Bar Association. So the ship very likely has sailed on Harvard, Stanford, Yale, you know, schools in the top 14. It's just like, hey, we can't ding our GPA profile like this, but you can still get full rides to schools that are probably just outside the top 14. If you get a 170 something and you just never even need to disclose or talk about, let them bring it up if they want to. And even then, can you imagine, like, what if you're in an interview and someone brings up your 2.6?
Yeah. Just say that was a long time ago.
Totally. Yeah. And I don't think it benefits you to bring up. Everybody thinks they need to like explain or have some excuse. I think you just look like so much more of a badass to just say, yeah, I didn't have any plans of going to law school at that time. Maybe that's an answer by itself. Or yeah, it's unfortunate. I was immature.
I don't even know if I would say that much. I just say, yeah, that was a while ago. And then I'd shift back to what I'm in. but you know, I've for the last 3 years, I've been working at this company and interacting with the legal department, and I'm super excited about what's going on next.
Yeah, you got to be slippery. Everybody should start watching the like presidential debates.
Yeah.
Right. You can pretend that you're Ron DeSantis and I can ask you like, hey, explain this 2.6.
Yeah.
And you just like immediately go, oh, that was a long time ago. And you just start talking about something else.
Yeah. It's not even like, you know, it's funny because we talk about politicians. It's not even slimy. It's like, who gives a shit? I got a 2.6. I have a 174. I've been working at some law firm for the last 3 years.
Yeah. Talk about the good things in your application. Yeah. If they don't see you as a killer, then they don't see you as a killer. Like you bringing up the fact that you had a severe substance abuse problem isn't going to help.
I think people also feel guilty, right? Or they feel like, I don't know if guilty is the right word, but like, sheepish. Like they're going to be found out. Right. And this is like, they're just like, oh, and they just like divulge. They're like, oh yeah, well I had this thing, but I'm so much better now. It's like, no one would ever know. So just let it go.
It doesn't help you to bring that up. So don't bring it up.
The next email here is from Sydney. The subject is addendum for gap in work.
Hi, Ben and Nathan. I currently am a live subscriber and love the demon. I'm writing in because I was recently laid off and I want to know if I should consider writing an addendum for my gap in work. I'm trying to get a mobile notary business started since I have previous experience notarizing deeds and estate planning documents. But I wanted to know if it's worth writing an addendum to address this, or if I should just leave it as is and put my current title of work as a mobile notary. Thanks for all that you both do. I wish I had found the podcast and Demon much sooner in my studying journey. Thanks, Sydney. You know, spread the word. What do you think?
Yes, I 100% think that if you're trying to get a mobile notary business started, then that's already what you're doing. That's your job. So
yeah,
just put that as your job and don't worry about it.
Yeah. And just fucking do it. Just do it. Just start a mobile notary business. I love this idea. I have a close personal friend who has been a notary previously, and it makes a lot of sense to start a mobile notary business. I love that idea.
Yeah. Like,
why not? Go get paid. Totally flexible, make your own hours, call your own shots, take the clients you want to take, don't take the clients you don't want to take. I love that as a job title. You know, not that any of this shit really matters compared to LSAT and GPA, but that job title is obviously legal adjacent. It's a position of responsibility, right? A notary. I mean, like notarizing a transaction for an estate plan, for a will or whatever.
Yeah. Yep.
It's got. Yeah, some legal cachet hanging on it. So emphasizing that, I think, is excellent.
Nice.
But an addendum to explain the gap in work?
No, all you're doing is then pointing out a gap that half these officers would not even have noticed. Maybe even all of them would not have noticed.
Yeah, and if it's your own mobile notary business that you're going to claim as your current job title, you can put the start date on that, whatever you want. Like there was no gap in your employment.
As soon as you started thinking about it.
Right. I mean, the day you quit that other job, you were a independent mobile notary.
Yeah.
There's no gap in your work experience. All right, last one. Chris writes in and says, do law school rankings outside of the T14 really matter?
Yes, they matter on some level. There's a difference between a school ranked 30 and a school ranked 182.
Yeah, generally speaking, we can go back to our 2X rule or our 100% rule, which is if the schools are ranked, you know, more than double one another, then you might want to think about it. And I think this applies at all levels. So like comparing a school that's ranked third in the country to a school that's ranked 13th in the country, there's probably some real difference there in terms of big law, federal clerkship, you know, the super prestige masters of the universe types of jobs. There probably is a difference inside the top 14 if there's more than a 100% difference between the two.
If there's not, then they're probably similarly ranked and don't need to worry about it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And this applies, you know, it's a very rough rule of thumb, but I think we can just ignore the top 14 entirely and just talk about, well, are they 100% different?
Yep.
because the school ranked 13th and the school ranked 30th. Yeah, probably significantly different. But the school ranked 13th versus the school ranked 19th. Probably not that. Probably not really. Like, I don't know. One of them is in the T14, but who does that impress?
Yeah.
I don't know. You'd have to show me a firm that specifically would hire from the 13th ranked school, but would not hire from the 19th ranked school. I think those, you know, you might be able to show those, but I think they're going to be pretty fucking rare.
Chris writes, I'm not going to get into a T14 school. Okay. I finished my undergrad while in the Air Force and my master's while working full time. So my GPA is like a 3.3.
Your master's is totally irrelevant to your law school GPA. So, you know, you need to, I don't care about that master's. It's almost like it doesn't even exist. It's a feather in your cap, but it's a feather on the back of your hat that like no one's even going to see.
Like, what's that?
What's your LSAT? What's your GPA?
Yeah.
You know, like what are you writing about in your personal statement? Those are the things that are going to really move the needle. And this master's is like, yeah, okay, great. You got a master's, but you didn't even do that great in it, apparently. But yeah, this, I don't know what you're doing. You're giving me a blended GPA, which that's not the way it works. It's only your undergraduate GPA that's going to count.
Chris continues, I have a decent LSAT, but I work full time and have kiddos, so I'm looking at a part-time program. So wait, hold up. Chris, you gave us a blended GPA, but you didn't give us your LSAT score. We have all the wrong information here. We need to know what your LSAT score is. Decent LSAT, by the way, varies widely.
Yeah, I have no idea what that means.
I mean, there are people who write in, they're like, oh, I'm doing pretty good. I got a 144. It's like, no, you're not. And then you have other people who are like, my score is abysmal at a 172. So,
yep. Right.
Anyways, yep. Where you don't know where you're at. So, Chris concludes, no T14 school works for my situation.
Okay. Fine.
Maybe. I am a consultant for a big four and want to transfer to the corporate law side of our firm. Does the school rank actually matter for someone like me, or should I focus on cost, availability of classes and scholarships, or the rank of the school? Thanks for the help. I like the blunt, honest answers instead of the sunshine and rainbows the others do. I just don't necessarily buy this assumption that you can't get into a T14. I mean, maybe. I don't know what your undergrad GPA is, but depending on your LSAT score, in which you could potentially improve, you might be able to even crack into the T14.
Sure.
So okay. There's so much that, yeah. What do you mean noted? That's like a big deal. He's already preemptively like dismissed this. And I don't know.
I mean, I think the part-time thing is maybe like the dispositive thing there, right? They're just, I don't know that there are robust part-time programs in the top 14. Maybe I'm wrong, but I guess I was under the impression that that was mostly full-time.
Yeah.
And with bad grades and, you know, a decent LSAT that Chris doesn't want to talk about, I guess what you're saying is, I hope Chris is not letting his mediocre LSAT hold him back from something that could be, you know, like maybe it's possible that Chris could actually get a 170 something and go to some big prestigious school.
And well, yeah. Even if it's not in the top 14, I don't know. It's like Chris is saying, hey, I like the blunt advice, but I specifically want to talk about something after a bunch of assumptions have been made. Yeah. And my advice is, okay, well, let's get back to the thing that actually matters, which is your LSAT. What score is it and how far could you improve it? Because that's going to make a big difference in terms of how much you pay and potentially get good schools.
Sure. The thing I wanted to focus on with Chris was, have you talked to corporate law at your firm? Because nobody knows better what it takes to get into their department than them. I don't know. I'm not a big four consultant. I have no experience inside the big four. I don't even know what you're talking about. You're talking about accounting firms, right? Is Ernst & Young one of them?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, I mean,
I think.
I don't know.
It used to be the big five. I don't know what happened. But yeah.
Well, but I mean, go talk to the corporate lawyers that you want to join. You should, you know, you want to be rubbing elbows with them. You should start rubbing elbows with them right now. Hey, I'm a consultant for your firm. I wonder if you'd have 5 minutes to answer some questions, or I wonder if I could ask you some questions in an email, you know, like, could we have coffee? Could we have a phone call? Find out from them. Or, I mean, you might even be able to just look on their LinkedIn. Like, where did they go to law school? It's possible that 100% of the people in the corporate law department at your firm all went to schools in the top 14. It's also totally possible that the vast majority of them did not go to schools in the top 14. Maybe they all went to part-time programs. Maybe they all went to full-time programs. Maybe the rank matters. Maybe the rank doesn't matter. But we can't blanket answer that, especially for something that's so niche as I already work in a big four accounting firm and I want to transition over to in-house counsel or whatever it is, like part of their law consulting team, or I don't know, whatever it is. You got to ask them.
I agree 100% with that. That's the thought I had as well. You're there at the firm. Like, this is easier than what it would be for most people.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's blunt, honest answer. Go talk to them. No matter what they say or no matter what you decide, it's always going to behoove you to get the very best LSAT you can. And I think that Ben picked up on something. You know, I think you're right, Ben, that this use of decent LSAT is like, is it? Like, what do you, is that like some excuse for, yeah, it's okay, but what I really want to do is apply right now.
Yeah.
And that probably is the ostrich burying your head in the sand. Just kind of thinking, oh, as long as I don't look at this, it's not going to hurt me. But no, it is going to hurt you on scholarships. And I guess Chris is asking, should I focus on cost, availability of classes? I guess that matters for part-time programs is what he's talking about there. And scholarships. Well, yeah, you should always be focusing on cost and scholarships. The scholarship estimator will show you the 509 report for every school. You can click into those 509 reports and you can look at full-time versus part-time. You can see, you know, do they give scholarships for the part-time program? But the best LSAT you get is going to get you the best offers. You know, it's just going to open all the doors and it's going to make the prices dramatically cheaper. So decent LSAT is not good enough. Get the best LSAT you can before you apply.
There we go. Thanks, Chris. Good luck.
Thanks, Chris.
Be LSAT famous. Please ask questions or share news with us at thinkinglsat.com. Questions about LSAT Demon, you can email help@lsatdemon.com. Check out our other podcast, LSAT Demon Daily. That was episode 424 of the Thinking LSAT podcast. Thanks all y'all for listening. Nice knowing you. Don't pay for law school.